Okay, let's move on to the topic for today, which is the Affordable Truths. Okay, as I pointed out yesterday, as the Buddha said, everything is fabricated in ignorance. It's going to lead to suffering. We talked about two kinds of suffering, there are two kinds of stress. First, there's the stress of the fact that things simply change. You try to lean on something, and then it's not there to lean anymore. That's stressful. But secondly, there's a second level of stress that goes on top of that, and that's the stress of clinging. This is what the Buddha is talking about in that First Noble Truth. That we cling to things, and particularly we cling to the five aggregates. Now these aggregates, as I mentioned yesterday, are activities. Even our sense of our body is kind of an activity. The mind has to be constantly monitoring what are these sensations coming up. That's an activity that lets us know that the body's there. When you're getting really, really deep into concentration, there comes a point where your sense of the body disappears because the breath energy has stopped. And there's nothing to confirm for you the fact that there's a body sitting here, that there's a lump sitting here anymore. It's just little dots of sensation. You go into the space between the dots and you find yourself in a sense of space. And that's your sense of the body is gone. It makes you realize the extent to which your perception of the body really is a kind of activity. There needs to be an activity going on, otherwise you wouldn't know the body was there. Feeling is the activity of taking in pleasure, taking in pain, taking in neutral sensations. Perception is the activity of placing labels on things. Man, woman, wall, light, whatever. It's an activity that the mind keeps doing. Fabrication is putting things together. The word sankhara literally means that, putting together. And consciousness is the act of, you know, basically being aware of things prior to the label. Now, of these five activities, sankhara, putting together, that's involved in all of them. As the Buddha says, it's for the sake of having an experience of feeling that you take the potentials for feeling and you turn them into actual feelings. There are potentials for perceptions, there are potentials for consciousness, and we actually intentionally put them together. That's how they become actual experiences. So these aggregates are activities to begin with. And as I pointed out earlier, yesterday, these are the activities that are involved in feeding. I think this is why the Buddha pointed them out as being really, really basic. You've got the form of your body, and you've got the form of that thing out there that you're going to take in as food. You've got the feeling of hunger in your body. It's unpleasant, you're going to do something about it. You perceive it, in other words, you label or identify it as a particular kind of hunger. Let's say it's hunger for something salty. And then you look around it and you say, is there anything salty out there? And unfortunately for those of us with high blood pressure, there are lots of salty things out there. For those of us like me with low blood pressure, I'm also happy there are lots of salty things out there. And then there's the fabrication. It's okay. How do I get that? How do I get here from there? How do I get that thing into my mouth? And if it's something that needs cooking, then you've got to cook it. If it's something that needs hunting down, you have to hunt it down. But basically, that's the activity that goes into getting it. And then finally, there's consciousness, which is aware of all these things. So these are all kind of feeding activities. And there's a second level, though, of feeding that goes on top of that, is that we cling and crave feelings, perceptions, fabrications. So we feed basically on two levels. We feed on the actual food, and then we feed on the process of feeding. And we find that we can really get obsessed with this attachment to our process of feeding, to the extent that we identify ourselves around that. And when we're talking about feeding here, it's not just physical food, but it's also emotional, mental food. Now, where do you get your kicks? You identify with that. You look into personal ads. Basically, people are talking about how I like to feed. Long walks in the evening, you know, times by the fireside. It's a kind of feeding. This is where I feed most comfortably. That's what everybody's advertising. Does anyone like to feed together with me? Or would you like to feed off of me so I can feed off of you? Okay, then. That's what personal ads are all about. So we identify with the way in which we feed. And you see this particularly in restaurant reviews. I can't believe restaurant reviews. You know, it was a little bit too crisp, or it was a little bit too this or too that. And you say, but what a picky eater. And of course, then they write restaurant reviews to encourage you to be a picky eater, too. Mm-hmm. Say, the word here, pali, in pali rupadana, for clinging, also means the way you take nourishment. And that's connected also with dunha, craving, which also means thirst. So the imagery there is very much a kind of a feeding kind of imagery. And so what the Buddha is basically saying is that we suffer because we need to feed. And we get attached to our need to feed. And notice when the Buddha is defining suffering, he doesn't say life is suffering. He goes through and just gives a series of activities which involve suffering. We'll be going through those in a minute. And one of the basic teachings he has is this feeding activity doesn't stop with the death of the body. The nature of consciousness as it's viewed from within is it depends on clinging and craving. And if it doesn't have something to cling and crave to, it's going to find something else. It's going to go someplace else. And if we don't get rid of this tendency, we're going to keep coming back again and again and again. This is one of the reasons why the Buddha defined suffering. He also included birth among the forms of suffering that are ended with a path. Now you'd say, well, birth happened once, and I'm done with it. Why does he bring it up? Because he says it happens again and again and again. And again, we're talking about experience as it's experienced from within, not as somebody would look at you from without. And when your body dies, the people standing around you don't see any activity. But you're there in the dying body, saying, look, I've got to get it out of here. Something comes up and you go. As long as there's clinging and craving, you're going to go for it, whatever. This is an activity of consciousness that does not have to depend on the body. I had a request this morning to deal with rebirth, so I'm going to deal with it right here. Because it is part of suffering. Some of the issues that get brought up are, one, people don't like to talk about it, as if it were irrelevant. But when you talk about rebirth, you're actually asking the question, hey, when I act, how far do the consequences of my action go? This is what it comes down to. This is why it is an important issue. Because when you're deciding what to do, you're also calculating what are the results, and how far are these results going to go? You know, if it's a one-night stand, nobody else knows, you say, okay, that's it, nobody knows, I'm done. But suppose there's the results of your actions that go beyond what you just thought. And you start thinking, maybe I don't want to go for that one-night stand. Maybe it's not wise. Or if you say, at least I've got taken care of myself here for the end of my life. I've got my insurance is in order, and I've got this really nice house. There's this really nice house down there. 15th Street, and almost a whole block, and it's nothing but trees. You know that one? I'm sure those people think, we're set. Okay, the Buddha comes along and says, well, wait a minute, what if you're going to be reborn? This is one of the favorite questions he likes to ask kings. So there's this one king who went to see a monk one time and says, you know, people become monks usually because their life is pretty miserable. But your life was great. You had a wealthy family, your relatives were good to you, you had all these other pleasures. Why did you become a monk? And the monk says, I saw that, you know, life is swept away, it is not a door, it offers no shelter, there's no one in charge. The world is a slave to craving. And there's nothing of its own. And the king says, what do you mean I have nothing of my own? Mm-hmm. And the Buddha says, and the monk says, okay, you've got all this wealth right now. If you die, can you take it with you? No. There's a lot of stuff that you amass, a lot of things. And as long as you think, okay, I've got myself taken care of, as long as I've just got this one lifetime, you're still short-sighted from the Buddhist point of view. Your actions could lead beyond that, and then what have you done to prepare for that? So that's the main question the Buddha's answering when he talks about the issue of rebirth, is, you know, how far do the results of your actions go? How much do you have to calculate? What do you have to take into the calculation? Now, some people say he addressed this question because everybody in his culture believed in rebirth. And that's just plain not true. There are lots of cases in the canon where people who did not believe in rebirth came to argue with the Buddha. There are also people who believed in rebirth, but they had different ideas about rebirth. I mean, what basically came down to in that time is people would ask questions, okay, what is it that gets reborn? What is the thing that goes from this body to the next body? And when they defined that, either would be something that either could go or something that could not go. And that's how they would answer the question as to whether you were reborn or not. That was an aspect of the question the Buddha just put aside. He says, you're not responsible for what it is, you're responsible for the process. So you were born this time, did you know what it was that got reborn? That got born, you were born. No, then how did you do it? You just did it. And it's the same with rebirth, it's something you do over and over again. And this becomes relevant in the practice of meditation, is because the processes in the mind that can lead to rebirth are the processes you're watching and trying to gain some control over as you're meditating. We'll be getting into this a little bit further when we go into what the Buddha calls the craving that leads to becoming, because becoming is this process that's going to lead to birth. That's something that happens in the mind all the time. So you're not responsible for what takes rebirth. You are responsible for the process of how it happens. Because if you don't get some control over it, it's going to keep happening again and again. So those are the main issues around rebirth.
Well, one of the doubts I would confess to is, and I think it's because the life I remember has been a very privileged, comfortable life, and so it's hard for me to really understand the undesirability of rebirth. So that's one of the doubts I recognize in myself. Is I don't really feel this commitment to escape the cycle of rebirth. I know there's no guarantee, you know, that I get, but anyway, could you?
Okay, well, that's the big one. There's no guarantee that you're going to come back and have a nice, privileged life you had this time. And there are things that you've come to take for granted. What if you suddenly couldn't have those? You'd miss them. You'd say, gee, I'd like to be reborn in Bellingham next time around. What do I have to do? It turns out being reborn in Bellingham takes an awful lot.
There are only 60,000 of us get to do it.
I know. It's a privileged group. I mean, right now in Wat Met Thai, it is 105. It's one of the reasons I schedule my retreats. But that's that. And for the Buddha, that was the terrifying part. You have to remember, on the night of his awakening, he saw his many rebirths, and there were not privileged rebirths, all of them. A lot of the very unprivileged ones.
If you still have growing to do, if you haven't had those final understandings that lead to non-return, it seems, I mean, it might be uncomfortable or unpleasant in the moment, but the growth itself would be something you might want to come or expect that
okay,
you would
well,
choose
I'll
to come
take,
back.
I'll give you this as an example. As I was saying earlier, Thai forest tradition was peasants. They were monks in Thailand who had been born in the royal family. They were totally cut off from the opportunity to study with the Jhana Monk because of that. So sometimes privilege is not a good thing. I had an experience years back. There's the palace that Rama V built for his family, basically. There's the royal palace, which was for ceremonial functions, the grand palace. And then there's this other one that they had built out of teak. And it was only in the 1980s that they finally, you know, refurbished it and renovated it and opened it to the public to come in. And I remember walking into the palace and thinking, I've got to get out of here. It was just felt like the most confining environment, because you think about all these, the king had all these wives, and you can imagine what it's like with lots of wives and lots of kids and all the politics and everything going on in a place like that. Just get out. So privilege is not always a good thing. So you have to think about it. Sometimes you have it, you get privilege, but it's hard to get just the right calculation. Okay, comfortable enough to practice and also the opportunity to practice. You know, the Buddha's image is like the turtle rising and falling in the ocean. It comes up every now and then, every 100 years comes up. And there's one, they say there's this hoop, it's kind of like a lifesaver floating in the ocean. And the chances of the turtle's getting its head through the lifesaver, that your chances of coming back and having a good life repeat the Dharma again, that's pretty scary. There's one case where the Buddha was talking to some monks, and he was like, what can I do to make these monks really sort of get a sense of the urgency of all this? And you know the image about the water out there in the ocean is less than the tears that you shed. Well, the image he gave them is, do you realize that the times you've had your heads cut off and the blood you've lost from having your heads cut off is more than the ocean? And then he goes down and he says, the times that you were sheep and you had your heads cut off, that's actually more than the water that was mentioned. And then the time you were cattle, the times you were a thief and you were caught and had your head cut off, the amount of blood that came from that, you realize, my gosh, it's not just me, this nice person in Bellingham, I've been all these kinds of things, and they all became arahants right away. So it's kind of scary. I mean, I know people who kind of plan out their lifetimes. Next time around, there was a nun I knew in Thailand. She came from a fairly wealthy family and decided to become a nun late in life. And she sponsored the building of a hut for one of the monks in the monastery. And I was looking in it one day, and she happened to be there giving the final instructions to the carpenters and everything. It was a really, really nice hut. And I said, gee, are you planning your little palace for heaven up here? She said, no, I've already taken care of that. This is my vacation home. And so there is that aspect. I remember that some Thai people were asking me one time, why is it that the Westerners, when they come to meditation, seem to be so gung-ho? And I tell them, it's because they only have one lifetime to do it. So there's the disadvantage. You can get kind of lazy thinking about, well, I can come back like this, I can go back like that. But then you start thinking about all the horrible things you can come back as, and it's pretty scary. So it's good to...
Healthy anxiety.
Anything else?
I was just curious, you mentioned that members of the royal family who became monks wouldn't be able to practice with Ajahn Mun.
The reason for that was Rama V had a policy to set up an educational system in Thailand. Now, you don't just set up schools and have teachers right away. You need land and you need teachers. And it's going to take them a while to set up an education system for lay teachers. Guess where they went for the teachers? Monks. Guess where they went for the land? Monasteries. And there's a very strong push that we want the monks to become teachers in the schools. Monks weren't told that this was going to be a temporary situation. That they were actually going to use the monks, and then when they got the lay teachers in, they're going to push the monks out, which is what happened. Secondly, became the government policy. First, we have to prove that we're not using the monks in a way that's inappropriate. So they did a little survey, and they said, they came back and said, the result of our survey is that there are no monks who are practicing for nirvana any longer. Those who think they are deluded. Therefore, anyone who thinks they're practicing for meditation for the sake of nirvana or getting jhana or any of this stuff is totally deluded. So forget about that, become a teacher. 1927, it actually became a law. All monks should be teaching in the school system. Now, Ajahn Mun was out in the forest and he was basically staying away from this. I mean, that's one of the reasons why he had to stay in the forest. And so the official government policy was that Ajahn Mun was deluded. So the members of the royal family who were in the monkhood, they stayed away. The reason that Ajahn Mun was able to do what he did was he did have one friend in the hierarchy who looked out for him. And then when he died, then the forest tradition was in trouble again. And John Lee had to go and find a monk in the hierarchy that would look after them. And so if you were born in the royal family, there's no way you were going to even think of it as a possibility of something you wanted to do. So it wasn't like you were barred by outside forces, but your mind barred you. favorite stories about John Lee trying to reestablish connection with the hierarchy. And the two ways he did this. One was this one monk in the hierarchy was sick, so John Lee went and visited him when he was sick and just sit in the corner of the room. Now, John Lee, as a meditator, had some special talents that most meditators don't have. And one of those was he could send energy to people. And so he sat there sending energy into the monk. And the monk said, "What are you doing?" John Lee says, "I'm making a gift of stillness to one who comes in." And the monk said, "Well, whatever it is, keep it up." And so as in coming every day, sitting there meditating. And so finally the monk started asking questions and John Lee started explaining meditation. Actually got the monk to meditate. And apparently got into fairly strong concentration. He said, "Boy, I've been deluded all my life. I thought that John Monk was crazy." And so then he set John Lee up to teach there at the monastery. And this is how this was the beginning of the forest tradition becoming in Bangkok. But he still had the jealousy of the monks to deal with. And so one of the things he did was there was an old woman whose job was to clean the bathrooms of the monastery. And so he had her come and sit and meditate with him. And she was meditating. And she got so she could read people's minds. And guess whose mind she read first? The monks in the monastery. She went and reported to the abbot. Did you realize? And the abbot knew enough about what was going on in the monastery to realize that she was right on. And so he called the monks together and said, "You guys got to watch out. They can read your innards." And so that's how the forest tradition got back, sort of back into, sort of worked its way back into the central Thailand. So that's why it was being born in the royal family was actually a strike against you, as far as your Dharma practice was concerned.
Yeah, better chance of being a rural.
Yeah, you're born in northeast Thailand in a poor family, you had a better chance. That's a rebirth. Any questions over here? Okay. So this process of feeding keeps going unless we learn how to put an end to it. Even when the body dies, you're still feeding. So why do we feed? We have three types of craving or three types of thirst. There's the craving for sensuality, craving for becoming, and craving for non-becoming. Craving for sensuality is basically this fascination we have with thinking about sensual pleasures and how we're going to get our next sensual pleasure. Once we've got one, where do we go for the next one? It's that fascination with thinking about this. This is what the craving is actually aimed at. For instance, you decide for today's lunch, you're going to go down and get a pizza at this store. Okay. You go down, it turns out the store is closed. You say, no big deal, there are other places, there's other food in the world. And you start thinking about where you want to go for your next one. And it's kind of fun. Right? Okay, what if they said, okay, no thinking about your meal for today, i.e. the life of a monk. What would you do? I mean, people would immediately rebel. Okay. Which shows that we're more attached to our thinking about sensuality than we are actually to the sensual pleasures. I mean, how long does a meal take? 15 minutes, 20 minutes? How long can you think about it? You can think about it all day, before and after. So craving for sensuality is craving for that sensual thinking. Craving for becoming. Becoming is your sense of who you are in a particular world of experience. And this is a process. Because your sense of who you are is going to change depending on your desires at that point. Okay, then you have a desire for pizza. What parts of the world are relevant? One, the fact that you've got this body that needs pizza. Two, the fact you've got the body that actually can get up and go down to the store. Three, what was that?
Pizza parlor.
Pizza parlor. Pizza parlor. Three, you've got the money in your pocket. Four, you're healthy enough you can digest all that grease. Or at least think you're healthy enough that you can digest all that grease. Okay, that's what's relevant. Now, there are all kinds of things in the world that are irrelevant to that particular desire. So for that state of becoming, the rest of that stuff does just not exist for your purposes. Now, we create these becomings all the time based on our different desires. And if you have obsessions for certain things, okay, those become permanent features of your world. This process of becoming happens both on the mental level and on the physical level. The fact that you are here as a human being right now was based on a desire for the human realm. And you actually had the actions and the abilities that got you into a human womb and survived pregnancy and came out and survived junior high school. And here you are. That too is a kind of becoming. In fact, it's the mental becoming that leads to the physical becoming. And we create these identities. You have the desire, and then you crave the ability to satisfy the desire. Now, your sense of self that comes into this is based on one, okay, you're the person who will feel happy when the desire is satisfied. And then two is your sense of your ability to satisfy it. These are the things that we identify with. So basically, it's yourself as the consumer and yourself as the producer. I can produce that happiness. And of course, there are times when you're frustrated, you've got a desire, and you can't get the happiness that you want out of it, that desire. That's that kind of becoming is a really miserable one. Then there's the craving for no becoming. You've taken on a particular identity and a particular world of experience, and you don't like it. We were talking about yesterday, you didn't read the fine print. You didn't realize what you're getting into. All three of these forms of craving lead to suffering.
What was the third one?
Craving for sensuality, craving for becoming, craving for not becoming. That's done to the becoming. Now, your sense of self here can be related to this body. We also, there are larger, more cosmic senses of self. In all cases, these are forms of becoming, and there's going to be suffering. We hear again and again that the Buddha is talking about you suffer because of your sense of a separate self, but you end suffering when you feel that you're connected with everybody else. That's not the case. When you're connected with everybody else, there's a lot of suffering too. When you're feeling one with the world and then you realize what people are doing to the world is, that sense of identity is a source of suffering. That's the second noble truth. The third noble truth is the Buddha's realization, and the realization that comes when the Buddha's attained awakening is there is an unfabricated dimension of experience that can be found when you stop feeding in any of these ways. Now, this is an aspect of the Four Noble Truths that I see more and more people, even Dharma teachers, are beginning to question, is it possible to totally put an end to suffering? Is it possible to know anything that is unconditioned? And a lot of this comes down to how you define a person again. What is your definition of what a person is, what a person can do? If you define the person simply as this biological organism here, it would be impossible to know anything unconditioned, because everything biological is conditioned. Here again, we see the importance of the Buddha's rejection of a materialist worldview. You're not just your body, you're not just your organic processes. Last year, I was talking to a Dharma teacher who said, you know, this thing about the unconditioned, I just can't buy that. How could a person know anything unconditioned? And I told him, you know, you're like someone who can read three letters at a time, and you see the word antelope, And so when you see an antelope, you see ant. And you forget about the rest of the word. So you're going to talk about the Buddhist theory on ants. Someone comes along and tells you there's more to the word than ant. There's also elope. This makes no sense to you whatsoever. Ants do not elope. So you got to stick with ants. He didn't appreciate the humor in that. So the Buddha's approach was the other way around. Instead of defining what you are as a person and then from there deciding what you can and cannot experience, he tested his experience, again, from the inside. This is the important part. What is it actually that you can experience? And he found that if the mind is properly trained, you can experience an unconditioned dimension. And he saw that one in the process, that one of the obstacles to experiencing that is the way we define ourselves. If you define yourselves in terms of the aggregates, you're going to be limited to that. You have to learn how to drop that identification. Basically, you can undefine yourself. The sense of the unfabricated is something that is immediately sensed right where you did, or where you were experiencing your body prior to that. It's a different dimension entirely. Now the fourth noble truth, after this short discussion, I am going to stop for questions. The realization that the process of fabrication, if you do it with knowledge, can actually lead you to that unfabricated dimension. In other words, you train the mind to feed in a skillful way. This is what we're doing when we're doing concentration. Concentration is your basic food for the mind on the path. Then you can become more and more sensitive to the various levels of fabrication that are going on in the mind and going on in your fabrication of experience. And as you get to do this in more and more skill, you finally get to the point where you don't have to fabricate anymore, you don't have to feed anymore. That's when you open to the deathless. So that's a kind of an overview of the Four Noble Truths. Any questions? That's an awful lot to digest.
So is the unconditioned the unfabricated?
Mm-hmm. There's two different translations for the same idea.
The second noble truth and the third noble truth, sometimes it seems like the second noble truth, the suffering is to be abandoned.
And the cause of suffering is to be abandoned.
The cause of suffering is to be abandoned, which kind of seems to me that if one was successful at that would be it.
Yeah, and the path is there to do that.
But then the third noble truth would be, so I guess sounds a bit like the second noble truth.
Okay, the act of abandoning craving will lead you to to realize the unfabricated. That's the third noble truth.
Okay, so the second noble truth, there's a lot of work to be done.
There's work to be done. In fact, and the third noble truth is what happens when the work is done. There's some discussion about, in the forest tradition, whether the third noble truth that really refers to nirvana or just to that first threshold to the nirvana. Because in nirvana itself, there's nothing you have to do with it. You realize it, and that's it. That's the only thing. That's from that point on, there's nothing more you have to do. Mm-hmm. It's not an activity. Whereas the other three are activities.
Regarding the feeding on two levels, the distinguishing between food and the process of feeding, is it correct to think of the process of feeding as kind of our habits and habit energies, and the feeding as the actual actions that we pursue?
And it's also kind of the second level is your mental fascination with this process of feeding. And because we're so accustomed to that, because we identify ourselves so much with that, that the idea of a happiness where there's no feeding, this kind of scares us. But then, and even the idea of, gee, I wouldn't have any hunger for pepperoni. Gee, wouldn't I miss my hunger for pepperoni? And the whole thing about this is that the third noble truth is so satisfying, you don't have any hungers anymore. It's not like the Stoic idea is, I will just deny myself this and pretend that I don't want it. It's actually, you don't need it anymore. Don't want it anymore. Yes?
Can you say again what the duty is with respect to the third noble truth?
Third noble truth is simply to realize it. It means to witness it as a reality. Did you actually see the reality as it happens? That's all you have to do. It's the Iqbal. I'd say it's the easiest of the four. It involves the least amount of effort. All the other four involve a lot of effort, and this is the last thing.
And if you realize that dimension, the condition, can you say that how do you then relate to ordinary life?
Okay, well, the realization of nirvana can happen in any one of four stages, you know, what they call the four levels of awakening. And after stream entry, during your experience of the unconditioned, you are out of space, you're not in touch with space, you're not in touch with time. You're in another dimension. There's nothing of the sixth sense field to touch you there. You come back in, and what you come back in with is realization, okay, one, the Buddha really did know what he's talking about. Two, there's more work to be done. Three, the reason I didn't see that was because of my past actions. Or I didn't see it before, so I got to be really careful about my actions from now on. Now, it is possible still to have, you know, sensual desires and irritation with people and that kind of stuff. But the fact you know for sure, okay, this really is there and it can be contacted through practice. That's something that you would never doubt ever again because you know it. And so your sense of attachment to the body is way less than it was before. And your attachment to things have to be a certain way is a lot less. But there's still a sense of you in there that's still driving things. That's what that has to be taken apart. So it's a series of kind of taking apart layer by layer. It's not like, well, I don't care about the world anymore, because you realize I've got work to do. So from that point on, that's what you're dedicated to, is doing the work that needs to be done in order to get full awakening.